from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, AirAsia defends its operation despite the continuing search for a plane missing following takeoff from Indonesia.
We have carried 220 million people up to this point. Of course, there's going to be some reaction, but we are confident in our ability to fly people.
South Korea proposes talks with the North and Africa prepares for a baby boom. It's all ahead. I'm Sarah Williams. Indonesian authorities confirmed that an Australian search plane has sighted debris in the water off Borneo, some 1,100 kilometers from the last known position of AirAsia flight 8501. But there's no confirmation the material is related to the missing airliner, which was carrying 162 people. Details from VOA correspondent Steve Herman in our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
Indonesian Vice President Yusuf Kalla says 30 ships and 15 aircraft, both planes and helicopters, are involved in the search for the missing Airbus A320. But he is trying to dampen expectation the missing jetliner, which the head of the country's search agency says is likely at the bottom of the sea, will be quickly discovered.
Of course, we hope as fast as possible. We have no target, but as fast as possible.
He noted that Malaysia Flight 370, which vanished in March in deep waters off the coast of Australia, has still not been located, and other jetliners that went missing in recent years took months or longer to find. The United States, China, and India are among the countries offering their resources for the operation in what is one of the world's busiest shipping routes. Aircraft from Australia, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore are already involved in the search over what is relatively shallow water. In Jakarta, the transport ministry says the government will review the operations of AirAsia's Indonesia subsidiary. The parent group's chief executive officer, Tony Fernandez, explained to reporters that until Flight 8501 on Sunday, AirAsia had never lost a life.
We have carried 220 million people up to this point. Of course, there's going to be some reaction, but we are confident in our ability to fly people, and we'll continue to be strong.
Indonesia AirAsia 8501, with 162 people, mostly Indonesians on board, departed Surabaya for Singapore's Changi Airport on what should have been a two-hour flight. But it disappeared about halfway to its destination. A pilot had asked air traffic controllers to allow the plane to ascend about 1,800 meters to nearly 11,600 meters to avoid stormy weather. But permission was apparently denied because another plane was flying in the area. Controllers did not receive any distress call from the crew, and radar contact was lost about 6 minutes after the last radio transmission from the Airbus. The captain in command was quite experienced with more than 20,000 flying hours, roughly 6,000 of those hours with Indonesia AirAsia in the cockpit of the Airbus A320. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Jeffrey Thomas, editor of the Australian-based airratings.com, tells VOA's Victor Beattie that AirAsia, up till now, had been something of a trend-setting carrier.
AirAsia came into existence as a low-cost carrier in 2001. The airline's carried about 217 million passengers since then. It's brought a low-fare revolution to Southeast Asia, and it's got approximately 160 aeroplanes in its fleet, another 200 on order. And up till now, they've had a fatality-free record, and it's a very good operation.
It seemed that there's a possibility bad weather may have had a part in this missing aircraft.
Yes, indeed. The weather radar returns we've had from yesterday indicate severe thunderstorms in the area. And we do know that the pilot requested permission to go left of his flight path and also to climb from 32,000 to 38,000 feet to get around and above the thunderstorm activity which was building.
This particular aircraft, an Airbus A320-200, is a very widely used plane, and this one apparently was fairly new.
The Airbus A320 in question was delivered in October 2008. It had done about 22,000 flying hours, so relatively young. But the Airbus A320, there's about 6,000 of them flying around the world at the moment. A real workhorse, very reliable, robust aeroplane that's used extensively by low-cost carriers and legacy carriers as well.
This was on a flight from Indonesia to Singapore. This is a relatively routine and, I would imagine, a relatively short flight.
Yes, it was from Surabaya to Singapore and left at 5:20 a.m. local Surabaya time, due into Singapore at 8:20 local time. Actual flight time elapsed. It was scheduled to be 1 hour and 50 minutes. The last contact with the aeroplane was approximately 40 minutes into the flight.
Would there be any hope that this aircraft may have been forced down and landed safely?
There's a possibility of that. I mean, as we know, with the miracle on the Hudson, an A320 was brought down successfully, mind you, in absolutely perfect conditions. However, from what we understand of the weather and the situation that was unfolding, this was a less than perfect scenario.
What impact, if any, will this have on AirAsia?
It'll damage their reputation, which has been extremely good. We will find that this was an extreme event, if that's what the outcome is, if it's a sad outcome. I think people will recognize it as a bizarre, extreme, one-in-a-billion sort of event. It will impact them initially. However, I think they will fly through this and recover.
Of course, this brings back memories of the Malaysian Airlines flight that still has not been located. What is the latest on that?
MH370, the search is well and truly underway. The first thing they had to do with MH370 with the new search area was to actually map the ocean floor, because the ocean floor in this area is up to 18,000 feet deep, which is basically the height of Mount Rainier in Washington State. So extremely deep. So they had to map the ocean floor. They've mapped 150,000 square kilometres of ocean floor, and they've now deployed three ship towing side scan sonars, and they have up till now, with those scanners, covered approximately 15,000 square kilometres. So there's a fair way to go before they cover the area they believe most likely the aeroplane came down.
In your experience, have you ever seen anything quite like Flight 370?
No, I think MH370, and of course, yeah, you know, we're yet to find out, you know, where it is, and let alone what happened. I think this will go down as the most bizarre and disturbing disappearance of an aeroplane in modern times.
Jeffrey Thomas of the Australian-based AirRatings.com. He says it would appear someone or a group aboard MH370 wanted to disappear and did an incredibly good job of doing so by turning off the transponder and other tracking systems. He says the airline industry may have to determine other methods of tracking aircraft in flight. And Thomas says there is a reasonable prospect that debris from MH370 will eventually wash up on the Indonesian island of Sumatra or the shores of East Africa, and authorities there have been notified to watch for such debris in the coming months. South Korea today proposed restarting a dialogue with North Korea on issues of mutual concern, such as reuniting families separated by the 1950 to 1953 Korean War. VOA's Brian Padden reports from Seoul. This outreach to the North comes at a time of growing antagonism between Pyongyang and the West over issues of cyber attacks and human rights abuse.
Rather than argue over what divides them, South Korean Unification Minister Ryu Kel-jae has reached out to North Korea to talk about the issues that unite them. He says the Unification Preparatory Committee officially proposes to hold talks in January on mutual concerns between the two Koreas. In the last year, Pyongyang's relationship with Seoul and its key ally Washington has grown increasingly contentious. Most recently, there have been counter-accusations of cyber attacks. South Korea blamed the North for a hack attack at its nuclear power plants. U.S. officials say Pyongyang hacked into a U.S. movie studio's files to try to stop the release of a comedy about the fictional assassination of Kim Jong-un. North Korea responded by denying the charges, accusing the U.S. of disrupting the internet in the North, and crudely comparing President Barack Obama to a monkey. At the same time, the international community has increased pressure on Pyongyang to address its dismal human rights record after detailing a network of political prisons and atrocities that include murder, torture, and rape. And there has been virtually no progress on restarting talks to both curb North Korea's nuclear program and lift UN economic sanctions. The South Korean Unification Minister's proposal aims to decrease tensions by cooperating on projects where there is already broad agreement. He mentioned reuniting families separated during the war, expanding cultural and sports exchanges, and preparing a celebration to mark the 70th anniversary of liberation from Japan after World War II. Military analyst Shin-In Kyun with the Korea Defense Network supports this modest proposal as a way of getting the two Koreas to talk about cooperation rather than confrontation. He says even though relations between the United States and North Korea are tense and there are various issues to be solved between them, he thinks the talks between the two Koreas are appropriate as the South should not disconnect the channel of communication with the North. Earlier in 2014, planned talks between the two Koreas were canceled after an armed skirmish at the border as activists in the South launched balloons full of anti-Pyongyang leaflets into the North. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is also expected to address inter-Korean ties and relations with the United States in his annual New Year's message. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
The last round of the U.S. Federal Reserve's quantitative easing, also known as QE3, ended in October this year. But the impact of the central bank's monetary stimulus is likely to ripple through the global economy in 2015. While most experts say the massive bond buying program helped stabilize the U.S. economy, it also sent billions of dollars into emerging economies. But as 2014 comes to a close, some of that money is starting to return to the U.S. Mil Arcega takes a look at what that means for the global economy.
As the year ends, more people are finding work in the United States. The economy is growing at the fastest pace in 2 years, and Congress has a new budget that effectively removes the threat of another costly government shutdown. Barring another political standoff, small business advocate John Ahrensmeyer sees an improved business climate in 2014.
Could be a better year than 2013, particularly if we don't see the type of shenanigans we saw with the shutdown.
Across the Pacific, China's economy has slowed after decades of double-digit expansion. But even with a relatively modest outlook of 7% growth, international economist Uri Dadush says China continues to exert strong economic influence in the region.
It's going to be somewhat slower going forward over the next year or two, but still sufficient to pull a large number of countries along.
But while improving demand is likely to benefit countries from Cambodia to Japan, European economies remain weak. The European Commission says growth will slow in the 18 nations that use the euro, with unemployment likely to inch higher in the new year. Despite recent banking reforms, Dadush says tough austerity measures in countries that receive bailouts continue to weigh on Europe's economy.
Italy is in deep trouble, and it's going to take some years even for the Spains and the Portugals and the Irish to come out of the mess.
Lingering questions also remain about the international impact of the U.S. Central Bank's decision to scale back monetary stimulus. With prices of raw materials likely to fall next year, economists say commodity-dependent countries could see their revenues fall.
That includes Brazil, but it also includes India, it includes Turkey, it includes Hungary, it may include Indonesia, that is also commodity dependent, by the way.
In the Middle East, some of the Arab Spring countries, which remain politically unstable, are expected to experience economic difficulties in 2014. Pinfan Hong is chief of global economic monitoring at the United Nations.
Nevertheless, we believe some improvements are building the momentum for next year. We expect the world economy to grow by about 3% for 2014.
2014 also bodes well for Africa. After expanding at an annual pace of 4.8% in 2013, the African Development Bank projects growth to accelerate to 5.3%, bolstered by strong growth in the service sector and increased agricultural and mining activity. Mil Arcega, VOA News, Washington.
Well, move over, Noah and Sophia. Lovemore and Nisumbiseng are gaining on you. As Africa bears down for a massive baby boom, the global balance of baby names is also going to get a lot more interesting. As increasing numbers of Americans are going old school or creative, parents across Africa are also drawing from a rich culture, history, and imagination for names for their bundles of joy. From the apple-cheeked Sundays of Nigeria to the roly-poly Alamihaeus of Ethiopia to the cute-as-a-button Perseverances of Zimbabwe, VOA's Anita Powell takes a look at some of the continent's more popular and fun names. She brings us this report from Johannesburg.
Mohammed Khan has a front-row seat to Africa's baby boom. The 20-year-old man has a stall at a popular Johannesburg mall, where he sells framed certificates printed with poetic descriptions of common names. New parents are his best customers, and through them, he has gained insight into the names of Africa's next generation, as the continent prepares for a massive population boom in the next 35 years.
Some of the most common names we get is Eli Mohammed, Yusuf, Ibrahim, also Dineo is quite in Uratile. So a lot of, very common names that come up.
Khan proudly notes that his given name, Mohammed, and its many variations, is the most popular boy's name in many different countries, including Mali and Britain. Most African nations don't release reliable statistics on baby names like the U.S. Social Security Administration does. Those annual lists of America's most popular names give great insight into the nation's psyche. Classics like Noah and Sophia took the two top spots in 2013. American names seem to increasingly reflect popular culture. The popular website Baby Center gives inspirations as varied as popular TV shows, celebrity culture, great-grandmothers, and exotic destinations, like the newly popular Kenya for girls in the United States. By contrast, Khan says he sees African parents reaching for meaningful names that stand the test of time. He says he rarely sees the trendy, quirky names that have become so popular with top celebrities.
No. We hardly get that. We do get, like weird names. I think someone came with Apple. Someone did come with Apple.
In South Africa, parents say they are trying to shed the nation's racist past, where many South Africans of a certain age were given an African name and a westernized, so-called Christian name. That included the late President Nelson Mandela, whose real first name, Rolihlahla, translates roughly to troublemaker. A teacher gave him the name Nelson on his first day of school. First-time mother Zanella is one of many new parents who have jettisoned that tradition. When her son was born a year ago, she named him Klanipo, which means wise in Zulu.
I feel that he doesn't have to have a Christian name. He can have a Zulu name and just keep the only name that he has, because we are Zulu after all. So.
Proud Papa Doki Mate named his first son Karabo, which means answer from God in the Southern Sotho language.
But like the new generation, we're trying to bring back that African, more of an African name that you know what it means. Other than our parents were forced to give us names that are English and they don't know what they mean.
But English names are holding strong in proudly English-speaking Zimbabwe, home of delightfully descriptive and self-explanatory names like Lovemore, Blessing, Bright, and Precious. And in some West African nations, like Ghana and Nigeria, parents name babies for the day of the week they were born. But U.S. popular culture is also spreading across the continent. 28-year-old Lindsay says she went for one of the top American boys' names, Aiden, for her firstborn. But, in true African fashion, she packed it with meaning.
I like the meaning of it. The meaning is fire. And his middle name is Dominic, D-O-M-I-N-C-K, and that means belonging to God. So, in full, his name means fire, belonging to God.
But old traditions continue to rule in other nations. Mozambique-born pastor Joaquim Livura chose to anoint his daughter with the Portuguese name Gabriela, which means angel.
In Mozambique, probably because of Portuguese culture, probably we do it European names, né? Not like here. Here they do national, like African names. I like it the way that they do here in South Africa, né?
These names and others are sure to keep entrepreneurs like Khan busy seeking meaning among names for the next generation. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Thanks for joining us for International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
This is Today in History. On December 29th in the year 1170, Archbishop Thomas Becket was murdered in Canterbury Cathedral by four knights of King Henry II of England. When Henry appointed his erstwhile friend and patron as archbishop, he hoped it would increase his influence over the church. The king became furious when Becket's allegiance shifted from Henry to the church. In 1845, the United States annexed the Republic of Texas. It was admitted as the 28th U.S. state. In 1890, 300 Indians were killed in what has become known as the Wounded Knee Massacre. The deaths occurred when a gunfight broke out as U.S. Army troops tried to disarm the Lakota Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. Wounded Knee is generally considered to mark the end of the U.S. Indian Wars. In 1911, Sun Yat-sen was elected the provisional president of the Republic of China, although he didn't formally take office until January 1, 1912. In 1916, Grigory Rasputin, the monk who had wielded powerful influence over the Russian royal family, was murdered by a group of noblemen. In 1937, the Irish Free State was replaced by a new nation called Ireland with the adoption of a new constitution. On this day in 1940, London suffered one of its most devastating air raids during World War II. On this day in 1998, following the defection of most of their followers and the death of its figurehead Pol Pot, the remaining Khmer Rouge leaders apologized for the deaths of as many as 2 million people during their regime in the 1970s. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One of the most effective ways to make life difficult for those who deliberately cause harm to others is to take away their ability to use their bank accounts or to raise new funds and to prevent them from spending those funds still within their possession to purchase what they need to carry out their nefarious agendas. So you lock them out of the international banking system, thus taking away their ability to transfer money to vendors and to receive money from donors. You freeze what funds they may have in the banking system, and you ensure that no businesses or manufacturers will trade with them. That is essentially what happens when the United States designates, under Executive Order 13224, an individual or group deemed to be terrorist in nature or likely to commit terrorist activity, thus posing an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security, foreign policy, and economy of the United States. On December 18th, the U.S. Department of State designated the Ajnad Misr Group, as well as Ibrahim Arubaysh, as specially designated global terrorists. Ajnad Misr is the only terrorist group that operates exclusively in the greater Cairo area. It grew out of another designated terrorist organization, Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis, announcing its existence in January 2014. Since then, Ajnad Misr has been the most active terrorist group operating in Egypt outside the Sinai Peninsula. The group targets state actors. To date, it has claimed at least 15 attacks on public officials and their vehicles, government buildings, and public spaces. Ibrahim Arubaysh, also known as Ibrahim Suleiman Mohammed Arbaysh, is a senior leader of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or ACAP, itself a foreign terrorist organization and specially designated global entity. He serves as a senior advisor for the group and is involved in the planning of attacks. He has served as a senior ACAP Sharia official since 2013. As such, he provides the justification for attacks conducted by ACAP. By designating Ajnad Misr and Ibrahim al-Rubish, the United States is taking a decisive step toward starving the group and individuals of their resources, disrupting their ability to execute their deadly agendas, and ensuring that they find it ever more difficult to carry out their acts of violence.
That was an editorial.